Welcome to The Connection, where humans and aliens converse, and where all the dots are connected. I'm Nancy of Zeta Talk, an emissary for aliens from Zeta Reticuli. They are here to warn of great cataclysms on Earth and advise how to survive this. The pending pole shift is not the end. Man will make his next leap forward to live a better time when aliens will live among us. The passage is a story about several different groups as they experience a pole shift. The passage was first written as a script, then later as a short story. It's the short story that is being presented here with character descriptions from the script. Part one was presented earlier, during which we followed a young reporter, Danny, as he encountered the cover-up when he tried to get a story printed. Danny then went camping with his girlfriend Daisy as the days of rotation slowing to a stop set in. The couple and some fellow campers take refuge at a local ranch when the pole shift hits. In this segment of the story, we meet Nettie, the lone survivor at a resort, who's being pursued by the Grogan brothers, who are dealt with in vigilante-style justice. We meet Nettie, used to wealth and the power this brings, but not a flaky person, good breeding. Tough folks in her line, men who run businesses and the women who stand behind them. Cool in a crisis and not intimidated. Nettie rises to a challenge in a heartbeat, surprising everyone, but in fact just showing her bloodlines. And the Grogan brothers. They're local thugs who are quick to take advantage of a breakdown in law and order. The brothers grow weed in a hidden valley and are used to buying a good time, taking advantage of the moment, and have no morals beyond obligation to self. Kept in line only out of fear of discovery by the feds, who are now nowhere in sight with the phones down. They also rise to the opportunities after the pole shift in a heartbeat. In this segment of the story, Nettie is on the run. Where cataclysmic forces tear civilized trappings asunder, nature often remains unruffled. Except for an occasional tree limb tossed into the tall weeds, the pasture lands look much the same. A horse and rider are emerging from the cow path that wends through the woods, riding hard. Nettie, her hair coming apart and looking like it hasn't been combed in days, is on the run. Her cream-colored jodhpurs are black in places, soiled beyond hope, attesting to the fact that Nettie has been living in them for days. Her face is oily and dusty, and the horse is covered with dust where the sweat is rolling off its flanks. She slows the horse when she gets to the next clump of trees, turning to look over her shoulder. Nettie sees what she fears coming behind her and speaks quietly to her horse, setting off again. The group at the farmhouse has constructed a makeshift tent set up over a rope strung between trees, weighed down by rocks along the edges of blankets hung over the ropes. Bedding of all kinds has been stuffed inside the tent, with some laundry hung on another rope strung nearby. Life goes on. A fire is smoldering between some stones and a pot is hung on a hook overhead. Some metal from the wrecked barn used to rig a metal beam over the fire. A menage of wooden chairs salvaged from the house is set near a table with three legs, the fourth a corner stabilized on a barrel. In the distance, Nettie comes into view. At first only a few puffs of dust are visible, but then the figure of a horse and rider. The rider is raised high in the stirrups, English style, leaning forward over the big bay's shoulders, helping the weary horse carry its burden as easily as possible. Martha rises from where she is washing and peeling potatoes and carrots for soup, watching Nettie race toward the tent city. Nettie dismounts before the horse stops, swinging her legs alongside the horse and under its nose, forcing the horse to stop short. The bay braces its front legs, its rear haunches splaying outward in a frantic bracing motion. "They're coming!" Martha, stuttering, says, "Who's coming?" Her hand to her throat. Big Tom is rushing up, a rifle in his hands, setting the rifle to the firing position. He has a grim look in his eyes, his jaw set, as he's been braced for intruders and needs no explanation from Nettie. She sees an ally in his face, their eyes meeting, and quickly states, "I'm Nettie Finley, Buck Finley's daughter. I was at the Clearwater Resort when it happened. Among friends at last, Nettie allows her face to show the strain of the past few days. Big Tom glances at the horizon, scanning, impatient for an explanation. Nettie is shaken. They've killed them all, even the baby. Nettie is having a hard time talking, overcome, but fighting the urge to collapse into weeping, clearly due in coming. I think they're following me. Big Tom, meeting her eyes, nods at her briefly, his jaw set, a silent understanding between them. Climbing to a hilltop, Big Tom is leaning against a large tree trunk, his rifle resting on a lower branch. The sound of a jeep is heard in the distance, engines revving, and the voices of young males whooping it up as though on the hunt for a prey that can't get away. The open-top jeep is seen bouncing along a dirt road through the field, moving in the direction that the horse and rider had taken, following the trail of dust puffs seen from a distance, and the occasional prints left from pounding hooves. Big Tom lowers the rifle, moving his eye close to the sight, bracing himself against the tree trunk. A shot rings out as Big Tom jerks from the recoil. Red has herded the group into the cistern room, where spring water is drawn and foodstuffs are placed for cool storage, an old-fashioned cooler. Red is at the door, peering out through a crack, his finger to his mouth, reminding all to hush. Red has his rifle resting along his leg, not cocked, but there just in case. He's standing in for Big Tom, second in command. Martha has her two youngsters close to her, one under each arm and leaning into her. Everyone is silent, scarcely breathing. Danny has his mouth over his hysterical girlfriend's mouth, her wide eyes looking up steadily and unblinkingly into his. He has taped her wrists and ankles and secured her to a chair, taking no chances. Nettie stands behind Red, peering over his shoulder. Frank and Jane are in each other's arms, Frank running the fingers of his good hand lightly up and down Jane's arm as she rests her head against his good shoulder. Big Tom is seen in the distance, walking down off the hillock, his purposeful stride showing no tension or hurry. He takes his hat off and waves it in the direction of the cistern room, signaling the okay. The door opens and Red emerges as Big Tom comes within voice shot. They won't trouble anyone anymore. Later, the group has adjusted to the lack of housing and electricity and running water. Behind what used to be the barn, the ladies are bathing, and a sheet has been hung between the water trough and the tent city for privacy. Martha, dressed in a bathrobe, is toweling off Tammy's head, while Tammy stands with a large towel wrapped around her tiny frame. Daisy's complaining that the water isn't warm, shivering and muttering as she quickly washes off with a wet cloth and slips into one of Danny's large wool shirts. Jane has recovered from her scalp wound, but still has a thin strip of white cloth tied around her head. She's being cheerful, or at least trying to be, telling stories to Tammy about pioneer women, how brave they were, and the hardships they bore. The obvious point is that these things can be survived. Nettie's washing with relish for the first time in days, soaping repeatedly and rinsing as though she thought this day would never come. Jane continues with her monologue. They washed like this all the time, and in winter, while standing by the stove, never hurt them a bit. Can be kind of fun when you think about it. The ladies walk back in a leisurely manner toward the tent city, laughing and joking, the tension of the past few days gone now that the threat seems to be past. But Mark, the pilot of a downed small plane, and his lover Brian are looking for rescue. We meet Mark, a businessman and small plane pilot who had a rough emergency landing during the shift, while trying to make it to a local landing strip en route to a mountain hideaway. He's successful, handsome and well-built, his passenger his slender and artistic male lover. And Brian, an artistic type, very dependent on Mark, someone who has never sustained himself and is basically a kept man. He represents that portion of humanity that will react to the cataclysms by going insane. As they approach, Mark and Brian see the women coming from their bath as they struggle toward the farm complex, relieved to find others still alive and well. Martha breaks from the group and runs toward the tent city to warn her husband. Tammy reacts to the sight of two strangers approaching by standing stock still, staring in their direction. Nettie, seeing that Tammy will be left behind, takes her by the hand and leads her along. The two men are limping, dusty, Brian almost staggering. Big Tom strides into view, coming from the direction of the tent city which the women are now jogging toward. He holds the rifle pointing straight up in a warning fashion, clearly stating that the visitors are to stop and identify themselves. Mark is the larger and more handsome, almost twice the bulk of the slender Brian, who has a thin face and light, fine hair which he wears on the long side. Mark is dark and tanned, hair on the short side and with a commanding look about him, used to being in charge. Mark puts his hand up, signaling to Big Tom that they mean no harm. "We're unarmed. We mean you no harm. We're just trying to find your phone." At this point, he glances past Big Tom and notices for the first time that the farm buildings that were devastated, scanning the view in silence. He says, more as a statement than a question, "I don't suppose your lines are up, though." Not yet at ease, Big Tom says, "Put your hands on your heads. We've had some unwelcome visitors, and I'm taking no chances." Red has come up behind Big Tom and hands him the second rifle to hold while he quickly pats the visitors down, nodding at Big Tom when no weapons are found. Big Tom hands the spare rifle back to Red and says to the two men, "Come on back and have some soup. You look like you could use some." City campfire, the group shares stories. It's evening, the last traces of the setting sun fading rapidly, and the group is gathered around the coals of a small fire, kept small and low so as not to attract attention. Martha's putting her outdoor kitchen away, stacking chipped plates and dented pots and pulling the sheet over them as cover to keep them clean. The new guests ate everything put before them as nothing goes to waste. Martha has seasoned the water used to cook carrots and given it to them as soup, a bedtime snack. Nothing goes to waste. Brian's slender hands are trembling as he brings the soup bowl up to his face, slurping the soup repeatedly, still famished. Mark is telling the group what he heard on the radio before their small plane hit rough up and down drafts due to incipient hurricane winds at the shift. "The winds were like a hurricane, but different, more erratic. Our plane hit some bad drafts. I couldn't hold it. We could hear the radio news guy talking about it, too. Where the bridge comes across the river, cars were abandoned, blocked traffic in all directions. People were flooding across from both directions, desperate. Little kids left, abandoned. Riots were breaking out, everyone in a hurry, and no one knows where to go, I guess, trying to get someplace, any place but where they were. And looting in the city. The police just weren't around, at least not paying attention. No law, and anything goes." Mark's face is like a mask as he relays all this, keeping his emotions disconnected so he can get through it. "Services were failing as people failed to turn up for their jobs, and power outages went unrepaired. Phone lines went dead, gas pumps were locked, and the stations closed." Mark shakes his head and says, "A never-ending mid-morning on the East Coast taking its toll." Mark pauses a minute, keeping his emotions in control. "We saw some of that, too, from the plane. Cars littering the roads, pulled over to the side, out of gas and blocked, and there was a bridge with traffic lined up on both sides, blocked by abandoned cars on the bridge. This traffic jam was getting worse, too, cars pulling up at both ends. We could see people walking in small groups across the land, too, setting out on foot. And all the while we could hear the earth moaning. I don't ever think I'll forget that sound." Big Tom nods in agreement, Mark glancing at him for a minute, and then continuing, "We heard that religious groups thought the end of the world had come, and lots of them, even atheists, were committing suicide, taking their whole families with them, taking the kids out first, just like that Jim Jones crowd." Mark leans back, resigned, his eyes dropping to the feet of those around the campfire as the story gets personal. "Brian and I were overland when it hit. first the compass started behaving erratic. Brian was trying to unfold the maps, but wasn't having much luck, and I had my hands full. Then the sky started to dance around. We saw the moon sliding across the sky just before the wind shear hit the plane, as though either the sky or the earth were on the move. Mark heaves a sigh. And then the winds kicked in. We had no choice but to land, and land quick. Mark falls silent for a minute, searching his memory for what he might have missed. We've been to the beach plenty, and I can recall looking out at that broad expanse of water and wondering once what it would be like to have it rise up and rush at me. You know, really big waves. Happens after a quake or something. The last thing we heard was the radio announcer screaming, "It's coming. Oh my God, we're all going to drown." And then the radio went dead. Nettie has been brushing Tammy's hair as she sits numbly, her stony lack of emotion being taken for a quiet nature. Nettie puts the brush aside and says, "I was at Clearwater Resort, waiting it out as the phones had gone dead and no one knew what was happening. I was up in my room, changing, when I heard a woman's voice pleading, 'Not my babies, please, they're so little.' Then I heard gunshots, then silence, and slipped under the bed, quiet as a mouse." Martha reaches across and, taking Tammy's hand, leads her away from the unfolding story. It was the Grogan brothers. I'd later realized they'd killed the other guests for target practice when they came up from the fishing hole. Almost everyone went there to escape the heat, you know. I saw them when I went to the barn to get my bait, fishing poles and fish in hand, laying there in blood and twisted in agony, all dead. I realized they were shooting everybody. There'd be no exception. As the hours passed, Nettie determined that the Grogan brothers were downstairs, getting drunk. They were laughing about what they'd done. Laughing. Talking about how people looked when the bullets hit them, how they reacted, the look on their faces. Then they'd howl and carry on. I was sick, trembling so hard I was afraid to move. I edged under the bed, lay there trying not to breathe, not to move, not make any sounds that could be heard. Now considering themselves masters of the resort they were never welcomed at, the Grogan brothers swaggered around, putting their muddy boots upon the stuffed furniture and raiding the bar and tossing empty bottles at lamps and vases. No phones, no law, and the brothers can do as they please. I heard them say, "This is more fun than moving weed." Then I heard them moving from room to room, seeing what they could find. I held my breath when they came into my room, didn't breathe, and they missed me. Later I slipped down the stairs when it got quiet. They were asleep, drunk and snoring. I went to the barn and saddled my bay. He follows me like a baby after I pet him a bit, quiet as a mouse. I thought I'd gotten away, had walked along the hedge where they couldn't see me unless I mounted, and I didn't mount to ride until after the trees there. But when I was riding away, I thought of something move near the house. I figured I'd been seen. They chased me, and there was no hiding as the sun never went down, but it was dim, and that helped me. They had to use the headlights on their jeep, or they'd have lost me. Nettie glances around the group, and seeing all eyes on her attentively, continues, "I was the only living witness to their crimes, and they weren't about to lose me. Dead women tell no tales, but I think they were on a power trip, too. Their guns ruled, I guess. These guys are sadistic. Once they got on top, no telling what they'd do." Nettie falls silent for a minute, putting the fear she felt away in that compartment she never wanted to open again. Taking a deep breath, Nettie glances around the group to signal a change in the story. Nettie had been walking her bay along the bed of a stream, trying to lose her trackers. "I was lucky enough to be in Clearwater Creek when it hit." The jolt had thrown both she and her horse sideways into the hip-deep water. "I took a dunking, had the breath knocked out of me when I belly flopped, and when I came up, all I saw were kicking legs and splashing around. It was a good thing I hadn't been riding. My bay was almost upside down, and there were hooves everywhere while it tried to get up, but we were both okay." Nettie pauses to pull the story together, piecing it together for herself at the same time. "I guess the Grogan brothers must have been drunk, loose as a goose, as they survived." Nettie falls silent again, having reached the end of her story. I wonder if this isn't happening all over. Not everyone around the campfire is silent, as Brian has been giggling, but this goes unnoticed by the others, rapt with the stories being told. Brian stares off into space, his face a mask, giggling softly, though nothing seems funny. Not all injuries are physical, broken bones and bleeding wounds. Catastrophic change unhinges many who can't adapt well to the shock. In the dim light of the continuous dawn, Big Tom is trudging back from the creek, a towel thrown over his shoulder. Red is sipping coffee at the makeshift kitchen table, both men alone as the others sleep in. Big Tom glances up at the sky and says quietly to Red, "Seems like this cloud cover is never going to lift." Red rubs the tips of his fingers together, examining them briefly, and says, "I saw this when I was stationed in the Philippines. Some volcanoes had been burping somewhere." Big Tom bends over the smoldering campfire, picking up the blackened coffee pot, and while pouring himself a mug of coffee says, still in the quiet voice, "Have you noticed what happened to Tammy?" Red has been dreading this moment. "I think she'll snap out of it. She just misses her dollhouse. The way she holds that rag doll of hers, you'd think it was all she had in the world." Clearly eager to talk about what he sees happening to his little girl, Big Tom is not going to be put off so easily. She'd never been like that, so quiet. "I couldn't even get her to talk to me yesterday, wouldn't say a word. Damned peculiar." Martha steps out of one of the makeshift tents, brushing hair away from her placid, sleepy face. She smiles slightly at the two men in her life as she walks over to the fire, flipping open the coffee pot lid to inspect the contents. "I heard you two talking about Tammy. I know she's not right, and if I could, I'd take her straight away to Dr. Townsend. But there's no way, what with the roads torn up." A wailing sound floats through the air, coming from the distance, but unmistakably human. Mark bolts out of one of the tents, beating back the blankets that act as the tent walls in his haste. He has a worried look on his sleepy face. "Where's Brian? Did you see where he went?" Red points in the direction of the whale, his face blank as though this is nothing new, and Mark heads off in haste in that direction, tucking his shirt into his pants and stomping his feet into his boots as he goes. "That's another one that's not right. The other day I found them talking to thin air." Shift, people migrate, looking for any place not devastated. The local mayor, along with some of the villagers, drags up along the road in front of the ranch. Roads and communications are disrupted, so they are on foot. We meet Herman, the mayor from the town, large and stocky, balding, takes charge if no one else is doing so, well known to everyone, a widower with no dependents, a realist. Anna, Clara, and Len. Thin, middle-aged couple, uneducated but outgoing and very talkative. They relay circumstances through what, under normal circumstances, would be relish for gossip. Lived on the outskirts of town on Len's military retirement pension and disability check. Len, of course, is a vet. Several people can be seen in the dim dawn, straggling along the winding road that leads past the farm. One of them pulls a wagon meant to be pulled by a pony, hauling another. The man inside is gripping both sides, bracing himself against the jolts, his broken bones complaining at the motion. Herman, a large man in the lead, stops and points toward the house, and the others look up, lifting their gaze from the road and looking in that direction. They move forward with more pep now, taking hope that they found other survivors. Big Tom has been watching this procession from where he's sitting at the table with Martha and Red, his hands wrapped around a coffee mug. "We've got more visitors." Red jerks his head around him and rises to go off to get his rifle. Big Tom puts his mug down and heads in the direction of the arriving travelers, apparently deciding by their appearances that they're anything but a threat. Big Tom walks with a firm step past the wreck of the house and out along the entry road. When he gets close, he walks with his hand outstretched, recognizing the lead man. Clara, a thin, graying woman, has rushed up to Big Tom. "They're all burned as though there was no escape, as though the fire dropped on them from the sky." Her husband, Len, a thin, bent man, joins in. Don't know where else, as the house was fine, and that ain't the weirdest thing we seen neither. Clara glances at her husband. You talking about that man pelted to death? Lynn, not accustomed to being displaced as the storyteller, jumps back in. It was like he was stoned to death, those little stones all over the road, and his car looked even worse. Clara, too excited to stay silent, says, poor man, he looked like he tried to run from it when the window shattered and there was just no escape. Big Tom asks, these town folks? Len and Clara glance at each other, but then Clara drops her gaze, looking down at the road with tears welling up in her eyes, temporarily overcome. Len is pointing toward the broken farmhouse. Didn't fare any better than you, and those that survived went off just like ourselves, looking for help. Clara adds, finding her voice again. Miss Farmington got throwed clear across the creek, up against the flood wall. Looked like one of them tomatoes the boys throw on Saturday nights, all red and smashed. Big Tom hasn't registered any surprise at any of this, and now asks, where are you headed for? No one answers, but after a moment of silence, Herman says, anywhere not like this. Big Tom nods in understanding and invites them back to the camp. We're not much better off, but we do have some coffee and fried potatoes we can share. Then with a gesture toward the camp and turning to walk back there himself, he says, come on back. The group gathered at the ranch soon encounters a rogue military unit. We meet General Max Flood, member of the secret government, who knew of the pending pole shift but was one who voted to keep the public in the dark. Got access to Dome City design from a contactee who was drugged and tortured during an interview. Ruthless and dictatorial, is not thinking of the public, but rather has personal plans to become a military dictator of as large an area as he can influence during the pole shift confusion. And Sergeant Gary Hammond, General Flood's right-hand man, also a member of the secret government and assigned to General Flood going into the pole shift. Sincere and kind-hearted, but unable to stand up to what he perceives as a military pecking order. Blind to the changing circumstances, he continues to follow orders as though he has no choice. In the wooded foothills fringing the valley, quiet preparations have taken place. In the swirling mist rising from the ground after a recent shower, construction is going on. A large silver dome is being erected, cranes lifting a section as orders are barked. The military, it seems, was not taken by surprise. They prepared for this day with construction supplies and have quickly completed the construction of a dome with military hands assigned to the duty. The dome design is one fashioned after remnants of sites on the moon and Mars, scientifically studied to withstand high winds, earthquakes, and large enough to enclose their own atmosphere with comfort to the inhabitants. However, they would be surprised to learn that a second dome has been constructed in the locale, one not inhabited strictly by humans, much less the military. General Flood, a vein in his bull neck throbbing, is impatient.
I wanted this done yesterday. We can expect stragglers to start arriving, and I'll be damned if they'll find us out in the open.
His non-commissioned companion, Sergeant Hammond, is hurrying to catch up to the general. Short and slight of build, he looks up at the general and says in a worried voice, Sir, I still haven't been able to get through to my wife and kids. None of us have. The general snaps back.
I told you that. Have to wait. We got bigger worries than that right now.
As they continue walking towards the construction site, another couple steps out from the tree bank. We meet Jonah, seen talking with Azeda about the Dome City and the military. He's a contactee, immensely comfortable with his role as a go-between but during the transformation to the Earth becoming galactic citizens. He's the informal leader of the citizens of the Dome City, not elected, but never challenged. A bit unkempt, he has his priorities straight. People issues come first. He's a single man and intends to stay that way so he can concentrate on what he considers his leadership responsibilities. He merges his human associations and alien associations seamlessly. Jonah is wearing jeans and a white shirt worn thin by many washings, his dusty boots and ruffled hair attesting to his careless attitude toward appearances. He's standing next to a tall Zeta whose post-thin body and stick arms are almost shocking when seen side by side next to the slender Jonah. The Zeta is gesturing toward the receding military man, his face turned toward Jonah, silently communicating.
Jonah replies, "They stole it from a contactee, tortured him for it. But they don't have much besides the shape. It's not like our places." The Zeta puts his hand on Jonah's shoulder and glances up. Jonah replies in agreement, "Yeah, I know. Before we're spotted and followed." At this, both of them rise in the air a few feet and float off, backwards and away from the scene before them. And at another location, Jonah and his Zeta companion are walking up through the mist, out of the trees that are surrounding a natural clearing. Jonah is explaining, "The injured you brought in have been getting restless and want to help with the work. They're asking for a role." We see that they're walking toward a large silver dome, toward the entry port at the ground level on one side. Off to the side, there are several thin Zetas transporting injured people or assisting those too weak to walk into the dome city from a dull gray saucer-shaped craft suspended a few feet off the ground. Those who can't walk are being transported by levitation, their prone bodies floating alongside a walking Zeta who apparently is in charge of the levitation and transport. Back at the ranch, Billy is struggling with his sister's stubborn silence and gets some help from a friend. Billy's out digging for potatoes in a field behind a tent city. It's gloomy as though early dawn, the trees along the creek starkly outlined against the gray sky. Their leaves have fallen off, not as they do in the fall when they color and then drop, but because about half have turned a sickly yellow and dropped while the remaining are still green. Billy is scraping and chopping at the earth with a short hoe and digging tool, turning the earth looking for potatoes. He has a cloth sack lying on the ground beside him, lumpy with the few potatoes he has found. He's dusty and frankly dirty in places, as much from his work as from infrequent baths. Billy looks solemn and forlorn, with a slight frown on his face. Billy drops to his knees to dig by hand, not noticing that he's no longer alone. Suddenly he notices a thick gray Zeta foot, developed over eons to deal with the heavier gravity draw, and the thin leg above it. The foot appears to be booted in a seamless gray material. Billy sees the foot and freezes, but does not look concerned. He eases back into a sitting position, putting his legs out in front of him a bit, and looks up, squinting. The Zeta holds a capped vial of smoky-colored glass. The long, slender fingers in the Zeta hand are wrapped around the vial, held in place by just a hint of a thumb, a bump where the thumb should be. Billy starts talking to the Zeta as though he's been doing this all his life, as though there were nothing unusual about the scene. He blurts out in a natural and relaxed voice, as though talking to a family member he trusts, saying quickly and with fervor, "She just won't talk to any of us anymore." At this, tears well up into his eyes. He continues, now with a quiver in his voice, "She stares at me like she doesn't see me." His breath quickens as though he were about to start crying in earnest, tears starting to stream down his face. "I asked her to come with me digging so we could skip stones like we used to, and she didn't say nothing. Nothing." Billy wipes the tears away with the palm of his hand against one cheek, suddenly jerking his head up and looking clear-faced at the Zeta. There's a moment of silence as he's obviously listening to something intently. Finally, Billy says, "Sure, all at once, you say, like a glass of water?" At this, he glances at the vial and raises his hand to take it from the Zeta. He smiles slightly through his dusty tears, glancing at the Zeta briefly during this, by way of thanks. Billy promptly follows the Zeta instructions, eager to help his sister. Martha, Billy's mother, has had a struggle of her own, as their meager supplies are running out, especially since they'd had unexpected guests to feed. Though it's midday, it's still gloomy, as though a very overcast day during early dawn. Martha is sorting laundry, looking for items to be mended, seated on a chair in an open area, the laundry scattered about her in little piles on the ground. Her two children are behind her on the grass, Billy bringing Tammy what appears to be a glass of water. He sits down beside her, holding the glass up near her face.
She weakly raises a hand, and he uses his own hand in addition to her hand to steady the glass as she raises it. Issues around the food shortage and what to eat have come up continually lately, with creative meal making resulting. Martha cooks what she and Red decide is good to eat, and the others are told not to ask. This has included atypical menu items such as earthworms picked up off the damp grass after the last rain, and some slow-moving possums Red has caught, as well as edible weeds. Big Tom strides in to talk to his wife, squatting before her so they can talk face to face. He looks up into her face and says, "We're out, plumb out, and the canned goods are going fast, too." Martha is unperturbed as she and Red notice this long before the others. She keeps on mending through all of this without missing a stitch, though looks up into her husband's eyes a lot, letting them know she's heard him. She smiles. "Red is bringing some possum back, and I've got some special soup tonight. You'll see. It'll be all right." Big Tom pauses, then rises to his feet.
"Special soup?"
Martha starts picking up laundry off a pile, folding it on her lap as though getting ready to go, and says, "Never you mind, it'll be good for you." Later, at supper, the group is gathered around a glowing campfire in the center of the makeshift tents. Martha is ladling out soup, handing bowl after bowl to the group as they come up one at a time. Some members of the group eat heartily, others sniff and ask, "What's in this?" but never receive an answer or even a nod from Martha. All eventually start eating. Billy takes a bowl to his older sister, sitting without motion or expression at the perimeter. She says, "Thanks," and starts eating in casual manner. Martha has stopped ladling, her ladle frozen in the air, tears forming in her eyes. She catches herself, taking a deep breath and trying to disguise the emotion in her voice, and says, "Anyone for more?" Tammy glances at her brother and giggles, sharing a joke, both of them unaware of the waves of emotion buffeting their placid and reliable mother. Len and Big Tom have been having a discussion, too, and now Len raises his voice slightly. "There's a lot of stories going around about these camps. Trucks seem going in on a regular basis just ahead of the upheavals." Big Tom is intrigued.
"Maybe we should get together a scouting party and find out what's what."
Always loving a good gossip line, Len continues, Repeatedly, and sometimes on a daily basis. Jed ain't the only one who's seated either. Plenty others seated, too." He scoops some soup up with a piece of bread and, after biting a piece off, says with great seriousness, "I'm telling you, they've got a camp there. They got supplies, and that's where we should be heading." What they find there will not be a warm welcome, however, but interrogation. A scouting party sets out from the ranch, determined to check out the military base. Crossing an open field, Big Tom, Len, Herman, and Jane, who insisted that the woman's touch was needed, are trudging through the overcast day. They have backpacks or cloth sacks thrown over their shoulders, boots on and jackets open, as they were wearing their clothing supplies rather than carrying them in suitcases. Jane brings up the rear, though she is following Len, who is actually the slow one. She's doing this out of consideration, steadying him now and then if he loses his balance by putting a hand up against his backpack, unbeknownst to him. She's a kind-hearted person and can see this veteran is a weakened man, struggling not to show it. Len is pointing toward the cleft in the hills looming up ahead. "Over there, they drove up and just plumb disappeared between those hills. Ain't nothing in there that anyone knows, and the sign says, 'Private Property.'" A lookout on the hilltop is watching the foursome trudging toward him. He picks up a portable phone and speaks into it softly.
"Incoming, 4:00.
The group is approaching a cleft in the hills, trees on both sides. Len is talking animatedly, waving his arm in this direction or that, while he describes what he and others have seen from a distance. Jane is glancing slowly from side to side, scanning the skimpy forest they are approaching with a half-curious look on her face. Suddenly Jane freezes, her hand raising in the direction of the woods they are fast approaching, her warning frozen in her throat as a military warning booms out,
"Halt! Halt or be fired upon! Identify yourselves!"
The reception is not what the group had expected. First order of the day, by order of General Flood, is to determine how their secret base was discovered.
A single table is furnished in the large bare room. The lights dim everywhere but in the center of the room over the table. The foursome comes stumbling into the room, glancing over their shoulders, more worried about what's behind them than in front of them. General Flood comes walking out of the shadows opposite their entry.
Who led you here?
This installation isn't on the map. Who led you here? His voice is firm and his questions posed as though he didn't expect any resistance. Len is almost squirming and the others glance at him.
Well, sir, I was formerly in the military and...
At which point he gets rudely interrupted by General Flood, who says,
Stick to the point. Who led you here?
Len gulps and said,
I did.
Big Tom and Jane had been taken aside into another interrogation room by a couple of military men in shirt sleeves, with their sleeves rolled up past their elbows, ties off, and shirt collars open. This room is small and close, so the military men are literally in the faces of those they are questioning. Big Tom and Jane are being questioned relentlessly with staccato questions meant to rattle them. The questions are broadly based.
How many in your group? Where did you say you were when it happened?
Herman, who? Big Tom is trying to answer the questions as though they were factual, not understanding, as Jane does intuitively, that they are intended to rattle them. She's composed and finally speaks, saying in a clear, calm voice, How long do you think it will be before the whole town arrives? What will you do with them? Her question silences the interrogators as she is seen past their bravado to their point of panic. Finally allowed out into the camp yard, Big Tom and Jane come out a door to join Herman and Len. They're standing close together, waiting, in the center of a complex of bland, colored huts. They're checking with each other as to what was asked and said. General Flood and his ever-present attaché, Sergeant Hammond, are to the side, being briefed by the interrogators, Colonel Cage among them. The colonel is shaking his head slightly as he walks up to the group, indicating their lack of success.
It doesn't matter. The little rat broke.
He saw action in Vietnam, and we told him we were going to cut off his balls and rip his guts open. He saw plenty of that over there, and he broke. They came from the Simpson farm just north of here. The general pauses and says,
Make sure they weren't followed.
And turns abruptly and walks off, leaving his orders deliberately ambiguous. To leave and return to the ranch, a despondent Big Tom and Jane with their guards are returning to the farm, backtracking along the path taken to reach the camp. The path is going along a narrow valley between rolling hills. All are walking single file. The half-dozen military men are holding automatic weapons, casually pointed down into the side as they walk, but nonetheless at the ready. Big Tom is in the lead and is walking slowly, trying to think or escape and stalling, not wanting to lead them back to his family. The soldier behind him gives him a shove, making him stumble slightly. Colonel Cage, who has been walking behind Jane, comes forward quickly, reprimanding the soldier with a quick aside, and begins walking side by side with Big Tom. Colonel Cage picks up the pace a little to put distance between themselves and the others, and begins to talk to Big Tom quietly. Is there a break up ahead where we can take a stand? Big Tom doesn't miss a beat, having sized up the colonel as a good man, and after a moment of mulling it over says, At the creek up ahead, it gets... The conversation is interrupted, Colonel Cage jerking his head around, hearing a slight but familiar sound, and immediately bolts back along the line. He jogs quickly up to the men following he and Big Tom.
Where is she?
His question is met with a cold stare, but as Jane and two of the soldiers have disappeared, the colonel has his answer. He continues back along the trail, picking up the pace, and soon finds what he feared. Behind a group of trees, Jane is struggling with one of the men who's trying to tear her pants down, while the other holds the automatic rifle in a relaxed manner, watching and leaning back against a tree. The gunman jerks his head around, seeing Colonel Cage running up to them. The rapist shoves Jane away and quickly adjusts his pants at the fly,
trying to conceal what he was up to. The gunman raises his gun and shoots Jane, who is staggered back in the face, with a short burst from the automatic.
She was trying to escape.
Finally reaching the scene, Colonel Cage wrenches the gun away from the gunman and, without missing a beat, lowers the weapon and shoots the man in the stomach, swinging it quickly to do the same to the rapist. While the two of them are writhing on the ground in agony, Colonel Cage walks over to Jane, determining at a glance that she is solidly dead, as her head is essentially blown off. He turns on his heels and strides back the way he came, his face full of tension and a film of sweat on his pale face. He's breathing heavily from the run and adrenaline, and runs his fingers through his hair, front to back, combing it as he strides back to the waiting line of men.
Let's go.
Big Tom is waiting with an anxious look on his face as Colonel Cage strides to the front to rejoin him.
They're all dead. It's over.
Back at the ranch, the women are washing clothes on some rocks along the creek. Nettie is snappish with Daisy, who's sitting back and barely dipping her batch of laundry into the water as though she expects to be rescued.
I'm not going to do it for you this time. Wake up to it. It's this or living grungy.
Clara is washing vigorously, a worried look on her face. Finally, she sits back on her haunches and says to Martha, "Do you think we'll ever see them again?" Martha glances quickly over her shoulder and, seeing her children playing along the creek bed behind them, out of earshot, says, "Big Tom knows this area, and Len knows how to talk to them." She hasn't answered the question, but it is apparent by her face that she too is worried and just trying to keep a calm front. Suddenly, Tammy shouts, "Dad!" Tammy is running and Billy jumps to his feet to follow her. Big Tom and Colonel Cage walk out of the woods, followed by the three remaining soldiers. The women have risen to their feet as Big Tom walks up to Martha with a grim look in his face. Martha says, glancing over his shoulder and flitting her eyes back to meet his quickly, "Where's Jane and the others?" The grim look on his face is her answer, and she flutters a hand quickly to her mouth, utters a quiet, "Oh, no." Clara is next in line, standing just behind Martha with an anxious face. "Where's Len? Where are they? In God's name, tell me what happened." Big Tom puts his left hand on her shoulder and says, "They're fine, fine. Don't get excited. They stayed behind and they're all fine." Martha is leaning her face into her husband's shoulder, biting a trembling lower lip and fighting tears, trying to use an embrace and joy over seeing her husband again to disguise her grief from the rest of the women and her children. The group walks back to the tent city, where we see Danny explaining to Mark and a restless Brian about the pole shift, relaying what he can remember from Professor Isaac's rambling dissertation. "It happens every few thousand years, and what's left of mankind starts over. I guess we're lucky to be alive." Brian is moving continuously, but in a slow manner, pausing after each move for a moment, first raising partially up and then sitting down again, crossing one leg and then uncrossing and crossing the other leg, putting his hands on his knees and then crossing his arms, swatting behind his neck and looking at his hand for a bug that isn't there, moving his head from side to side as though looking in every direction, restless and a bit paranoid. Mark is in denial, even though he's experienced it. "Yeah, well, I don't believe any of it. If something like that was going to happen, the government would have told us. I think it was just an earthquake." A look of relief crosses Mark's face as he sees Big Tom and the women approaching. "Hey, there they are." Mark starts to rise from his seat to greet the group coming back from the creek. Danny turns also, a smile on his face, but the smile slowly disappears as he sees missing members. Brian has bolted into the tents at the sight of the military men. Big Tom sets the tone and takes charge of the big lie. "They're waiting for us, and we have to pack up and join them." Happy to hear this news, Danny starts nodding his head and muttering, "Cool, we're out of here." Daisy comes up to him, immediately starting her whining mode again, as she thinks things are back to normal again. "I'll need to see the hairstylist right away. My hair's just a mess." She is tugging at her pants and blouse, trying to straighten up and adjust back into appearance expectations she has put aside. Big Tom crawls into the tent where a sleepy Frank is just waking up from a nap.
"Come on, guy, time to move out."
Frank blinks and says, "You're back? Where's Jane?"
Big Tom, trying to keep up the big lie, says calmly,
"We're going to meet them. Hurry up. Grab your things."
The group is leaving the farm, carrying only pillowcases stuffed with personal items. Martha stops briefly, turning slightly to glance back at the ranch with long, lingering, sad look at the home and lifestyle she knows she will never see again. Tammy's at her side.
"Do you think they'll have dollhouses?"
Martha, wanting to encourage her daughter's return to normalcy, chatters back, saying brightly,
"Wouldn't be surprised that they'll even have some other little girls your age."
Colonel Cage is walking with Frank, who's just been told of his wife's death. He is taking this stoically, and they're walking at the side of the others who have spread out and are not in the line anymore. Frank is pale and barely moving. At least she didn't suffer. The colonel, still enraged at what has occurred, says,
"No, but I made sure they did."
Big Tom and Danny are taking the lead. Big Tom is explaining the situation to Danny.
"I don't know where we're going, but we had to leave, and soon. They were sent to kill us."
His face is grim, and he glances repeatedly at Danny's face as he says this, checking out the terrain ahead of them in between these glances. The pace is not slow, and the field is rough, so one has to watch their step. Danny looks confused and troubled, keeps looking like he wants to say something, but stops when the words don't come together. Finally, "So they're all dead, Lem and Herman?" Big Tom pauses, faced with a question he himself does not want to answer.
"I don't know, but we've got to assume that, I guess. Just don't say anything to the women."
In the next segment, the group led by Big Tom and Colonel Cage discover evidence of cannibalism, and then arrive at the riverbank where they encounter another survivor camp. They're followed by the rogue military unit under General Flood, who's determined to quell any insubordination. On the run once again, they arrive at the Dome City run by Jonah and the Zetas. Mark and Brian, meanwhile, rig an air balloon and return to the East Coast, passing over horrific sights along the way. At the Dome City, Jonah introduces the group to some special children, and Colonel Cage sets out to recover his family under the watchful eye of a Zeta.
"Hello, I'm Roger, president of Troubled Times Incorporated. We're a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping mankind survive during troubled times when self-sufficiency may be the only answer. Our organization offers a twin set CD of survival information at cost to the public. The CDs are in hypertext and PDF format, two popular browser formats, and contain all the information collected by the massive Troubled Times website. The CDs allow you to browse this information offline at your leisure. The cost of the twinned pair is $4.10, and this includes postage. You can also get the survival booklet, a hip-sized booklet of the gift of the Troubled Times advice, for just $5, including postage. We offer a popular combo package for $7.50 that includes both the CDs and the booklet, with the lower postage expense reflected in that price. Send for your copies today to start making practical plans for your and your family's survival. Just click on the $4.10 CD link at www.zetatalk.com, and your copy will be on its way."
That concludes our broadcast. Thank you for being with us. Remember to carry love in your heart. It's the commodity of the future. As the Zetas say, love may have a blooming going into the shift, as it ought, those with great love in their hearts responding to the realization that little else matters.